My name is Clayton, and welcome to another episode of the Watch Dog Podcast. I'm a professional dog runner and watch enthusiast talking to his pals about dogs and watches. How is everybody doing? Thank you so much for listening. You know, I appreciate it. And we're breaking the impromptu summer vacation I took from the podcast with my good friend from the Hot Take Time podcast and the Pete McConville YouTube channel. Pete McConville, welcome back, my friend. How are you?
Thank you very much. I'm excellent, Clayton, although I seem to have broken your intro. You've had to go back to the old intro music.
Well, I have people that like that. It's divisive. Some people really like that, and some people think it's an absolute abomination. I like how you do it. You use, in your podcast, Hot Take Time, you use different theme songs like every episode, I think.
To be honest, I would like to, and I try to. When the gun's being held to my head and I'm looking at the countdown clock and going, oh, come on, I've got to get this done. It is tempting to just reach back and what I did last time. And then, like you get so many complaints and the balancing the audio and all that sort of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Hate that.
So are you, yeah, what's the feedback on the podcast? Are you getting a lot of that, like sound quality? I think your sound quality is great. But do you get a lot of those?
We are actually. So we've got a bit of an advantage coming from the YouTube thing. And one of the things I learned through YouTube is sound is so much more important than video.
Yes.
And that people will watch the world's worst, like 720p, like phone recording, but they won't watch or listen to something which is like grating or where the sound's bad. So,
yeah.
It's all very exciting when you get into YouTube and you want to run off and buy like expensive cameras, and then you find out, oh, I don't need the camera. I actually need a decent microphone.
Yeah, because a lot of people have, and also there's some people put a lot of effort into like the intro to every video, and then it cuts to the actual like content and it's terrible, like video quality and sound quality. You think like, oh boy, this is going to be great because this intro is killer, and then they go to the actual video and it's, you know, there's no mic at all being used. It's like the video camera mic or something.
I fear I'm guilty of that. I try not to. I try really hard to get it right. And I'm slowly chipping away at the production quality thing. But yeah, the feedback on the podcast has been great. It's very unstructured. It's really just me and John just chatting about stuff that sort of piqued our interest. It's always curious because with me doing the YouTube thing, I'm kind of compelled to be involved in a lot of watch media and paying attention to what's going on. He's an interesting guy in that loves watches. As we were discussing, I won't talk too much, but you know, he goes through a lot of watches, but very little watch media. He really comes at it with a very clean slate, which makes it a really interesting discussion.
Yeah.
He hates it when we do new release videos because it's like, oh, now I've got to go look at stuff.
Yeah, you and I are probably, jaded. We're probably subscribed to way more channels than we would like to be. I am for Watch Soup and some like I really can't stand. But when Bobby asked me to be on Watch Soup again, I was like, and I was resubscribing to some of these channels. I was like, oh, gosh. Hopefully we never discuss anything from this.
I split my YouTube identity, and we can talk about this another day. I've some things I learned about like how humans work is I've gone back and been really diligent in being very careful about what media I consume and sort of how I train my desires and my preferences. But when you work in the industry, you kind of have to look at everything.
Right.
So what I do is I have two YouTube personalities, me personal, Pete McConville, and then Pete McConville Watches. And Pete McConville Watches subscribes to like 250 watch-related channels. Oof. And podcasts. And I just scan that and see what's going on. But Pete McConville, the person, I think I follow three. actually listen to and pay close attention to. So I really carefully separate those two things out.
Yeah, YouTube was something I never really consumed much of at all before watches. And then I discovered the watch content, and then I followed other interests too. And like, oh yeah, there's YouTube videos about watches. There's YouTube videos about like fantasy football. I like fantasy football or running type things or horror movies. I follow some of these horror movie channels that I follow have, 5-6 million subscribers. Crazy.
Yeah. That is actually one of the really interesting things watching when you get into like YouTube more generally and you see the other really big channels. My daughters, when they come around, oh God, if I watch another video on the Korean method of skincare, I will just tear my eyes out.
But I bet they have millions of subs, right?
Oh, they have millions of subs and tens of millions, hundreds of millions of views.
Wow.
Yeah, they just make the biggest watch channels in the world look hopelessly amateur.
Yeah. It's crazy.
And it's funny because you can see where people like Nico Leonard get his ideas from. He is a fairly straightforward, typical makeup and women's wear kind of YouTuber. He just took what they do and then brought it to watches.
Right.
It's almost like through my daughters, I can almost see where he got his ideas from. Huh. But it's fascinating. And no, I'm never going to do that.
Well, I have one more funny related story before we move on. So I did not mean to take a 4-week hiatus. 2 weeks ago, Sanjay and I recorded an episode on the new 62 MOS release from Seiko, the SJE 093. So we recorded that episode, and right after that, my wife and I went to New Jersey for the weekend for her family reunion. So I brought the SD card, thinking I'm going to edit this. I get up early, my wife sleeps in, so that'll be a perfect opportunity to edit the podcast. Of course, that didn't happen. We get back from New Jersey, and I realize I left my SD card in the hotel room in New Jersey. So I had to like tell Sanjay, I'm so sorry. He woke up like extra early, like 6 a.m. on Saturday morning to record with me. It's fun talking anyway, but you wish it bore some fruit. So I'm such an idiot. Oh, I did. Yeah, I told him. Hey, I'm an idiot. I lost it.
would have been tempting to say, oh, look, I tried, but the audio was bad.
Your audio was terrible.
Look, Sanjay, can you get up a bit earlier and check
right.
it away?
No, and he's, we're trying to get together to do it again, but he's crazy busy. And the thought that he's even entertaining the idea of recording with me again after I did that. He's such a nice guy, but that's why I've been away for a while. I wasn't supposed to be, but
I think that's quite right. I think you did choose the right person to like dick over,
right?
he's gonna be so polite about it. So there are other people. That's it. You're never again.
All right. Before we get into the main topic, what watch are you wearing this evening? This morning for you?
In keeping with the discussion today, I am wearing my 1970-ish, I'm not sure exactly what the year is, manual wind Breitling Sprint chronograph. It's a lovely, cool little watch. Almost certainly got a replacement dial and hands. Maybe there's some other bits that aren't original. I know the movement is the case. Is all the important bits are, so I love it.
Is that where Bulova got the inspiration from for their surfboard watch?
I don't know. I think there was probably that surfboard look, and this is the tricky part when you go back in time.
Yeah,
it is very possible that what actually happened, especially back then, it still happens now, which a lot of people don't understand. But it's very possible back then it was actually the dial manufacturer who got this really cool idea and thought to himself, hey, I can do this. And then they're the dial provider for like 20 different brands. So they turn up and say, hey, I can do this new dial for you. And suddenly 20 different brands have got the surfboard dial.
Interesting.
And that happens right now. If you talk to people that own brands, they'll tell you, you know, like their supplier rang them and said, we've got hold of this new material, or we've got hold of this new machine, and we can now do these shapes that we couldn't otherwise do. But you see, they're not just saying that to one manufacturer, one brand. They're saying it to every brand.
Yeah.
And so what we think of as all the brands watching each other and copying are actually changes going on upstream a little bit that are just flowing to all the brands at the same time.
Huh. Yeah, you see that a lot with like certain micro brand, you know, where this case came from, because, you know, five other micro brands have the same case or something like that. Yeah, you see that a lot. Bracelets. Yeah.
And often it's not even the same case or the same bracelet, but it will be suddenly everyone seems to have figured out how to do a curved lug. There might be different curves, but they're all starting to do curved lugs. Everyone suddenly got micro adjust. Everything's a little bit different. The bracelets are a little bit different, but everyone's got that. It's because their supplier has now worked out how to do that. Huh. And even if it now goes to like five or six slightly different shapes, you know, you're all getting the same sort of thing. And we all go, oh, they're all copying each other, when it was actually just something their supplier figured
right
out.
Huh, that's cool. I'm wearing one of the only vintage watches I have. It's a vintage Seiko. It's a 7A287069, the first quartz chronograph movement ever, analog chronograph. This one's from 1983. It's a pretty rare model. It's a PVD-coated watch. PVD-coated watches that are 40 years old typically lose a lot of the coating. This is all intact. Everything, as far as I know, is original on this watch. It's titanium, so it's super light. Very cool. Very cool, fun-to-wear watch. Thin, light, great, great summertime watch. I used the chronograph on my dog walk tonight with my pups. Yeah, it's a fun watch to wear. Don't feel like I have to baby it. It's still built. These movements were made to be serviced, you know, not a throwaway quartz movement. This is a totally serviceable movement. It's jeweled, all that. So,
oh, fantastic. No, yeah. That's very cool. And it does feel weird to say 1983 is vintage.
Yeah, I know. But I guess it is, right?
Sums, I'm doing the sums in my head. That is 40 years ago, so I think that counts.
Yeah, 40 years ago. Gosh. Sometimes in the 90s are going to be vintage. That one's going to hurt.
Oh, no, that's already happened.
Oh, God. Probably playing 90s music on classic rock radio stations, too.
They are.
Pearl Jam's probably classic rock now.
It is funny you should mention that. We have an FM radio station over here which plays classic rock. And yes, they were playing Radiohead and Pearl Jam.
Oh my gosh. Oh gosh. Okay. Well, we're talking about vintage watches. I don't know if everybody saw, I'll put a link to it in the show notes. Maroon 5 singer, I guess. I'm not a Maroon 5 guy, but yeah, he's all been all over the place. Adam Levine, he was on Talking Watches from Hodinkee with Ben Clymer. You know, I watched it when it came out, like you said, I think, in your live stream with Sam on the Casual Watch Reviews YouTube channel. I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. You know, generic rich guy watches, right? But, yeah. You know, there is watches. He's I don't know. He didn't strike me. I watched it before all this other stuff came out. So he just didn't strike me as a guy who was super into watches. I did catch the, like, you know, Oyster Perpetual Steel Day Date, whatever he said. That was like his first Rolex, which doesn't exist. Whatever he said. But, you know, he's a guy who had money, who has a few nice watches, doesn't have this, you know, huge collection. He said he made some selling mistakes, made some buying mistakes. Then after that, a bunch of people came out and said, you know, that some of those are redialed. Some of those are Franken watches. Perez Scope, who does some sort of investigative watch journalism, broke that whole, you know, fake Omega auction story a while back, came out and said, you know, these are Franken watches or fake bezels and crown pushers and all of this. So, yeah, you were talking about this on the Casual Watch Reviews, and I'll let you kind of go into what you were saying, but I largely agree with you. But then I wanted to talk about just vintage in general. It's, And another thing you mentioned, there are certain maybe gatekeepers in the vintage community that scare people off. And I think I fall into that category. I'm so focused on making sure I'm getting something that's authentic, that's, you know, completely original or using OEM parts, whatever it might be, that it scares people off when people like Eric Wind sort of say it has to be original and condition, but yet they don't want polishing. So I was always confused by that. But yeah.
Yeah, although he is changing his tune on that one. I heard him in an interview recently. But yeah, so basically, to sum it up, I said this is why people don't like a periscope.
Yeah.
Now, what I'm going to lead with a bit of a disclaimer and say that when Periscope does his deep dives into watches that have been offered for sale, that is fantastic. Yeah. And that is an invaluable resource, because when you're in that very commercial and often for very large, you know, sums of money, when you're doing those exchanges, absolutely, it is super important that everyone knows what they're buying and what's being sold. So when Periscope, you know, dives into watches that have been sold, I'm on board. Well done. When he turns up and starts talking to, you know, critiquing just some schmo who's bought some nice watches and he kind of likes them, and then, and I don't care how much money they cost, that's not my problem, that's not Periscope's problem. When you start critiquing some guy, his personal collection, and going out publicly and labeling them Franken watches, then you're the guy no one likes.
Right.
Frankly, you're being a bit of an ass. And that's my take on Periscope, that he didn't seem to separate out the importance of tracking heritage and provenance and originality in a sale, which is all about heritage and provenance and originality, and some guy who's bought a watch.
Yeah.
And my concern was, and the point that I raised on the podcast, the live stream, was it's that sort of behavior that gets in the way of normal people buying a watch, buying a vintage watch. Now, as we were talking about beforehand, I own a bunch of vintage watches. They, you know, I'm just going to pluck a number, probably about 30-ish. I come at vintage watches the same way I came at classic cars back when I used to do cars. And there are two types of people that are into classical vintage cars. Conkers people. Conkers is like the Pebble Beach, stick it on your trailer at somewhere, you steam clean it before you roll out onto the grass. You go through and you clean everything up with a toothbrush. And people have got like these, have been paying a fortune for old microfiche records to make sure that the the brake liners line up with the paint scheme, which lines up with the upholstery, and blah, blah, blah. Who gives a rat? There's those guys, they're really boring and no one wants to talk to them. And then there's the more interesting and exciting people who are all standing around the barbecue at a race club with their old cars. They're in the classic and heritage race collections, but we've stripped everything out. If it, all the interior panels are gone. Who cares if the original only came with 45 mil Webers? I've gone for 48s. Who cares if, you know, this had originally Kony, you know, shocks? Bilstein are better, so I'm going with Bilsteins. You know, that's how we roll. I think you can do the same in watches. There are the people like Periscope and John Wind and I think John Goldberg.
You know,
Goldbergers. These very high-end collectors, they're like the Pebble Beach Conkers guys that exchange big money, but the money is the only thing really exciting about their watches. But there's this whole other community that no one talks about, of people who just buy old watches because we like old watches and we don't care about the value, and I don't want my watches ever to go to Christie's, and I just love this old sprint. The movement is a very, very slight derivative of a Valjoux 7730, I think. super easy to replace if it ever needs to get broken. You know, worst comes to worst, I would have, and I've had this discussion with a watchmaker on a watch I bought where we weren't sure if it could be brought back to life. I actually said, is it possible that you could just like basically gut it and then take a 7750 and take some of like the important bits with the name and everything off my watch and put it on that? And he went, yeah, sure. We can do that. And I thought, cool, resto mod my watch. I don't care. And I love that. I've got old Alpinas that I bought an old Alpina, fantastic watch, but the movement was shot. And can you buy an Alpina 538 movement anyway? Of course you can't. But the Alpina 538 is basically a Unitas movement. Okay. Can you buy an old Unitas movement, the same shape and size, and then throw the plate on it that's got the Alpina number? Yeah, sure you can. Why not? Now, I'm never going to sell that watch, and if I was going to sell it, I'd be telling the buyer exactly what I did.
Right.
But in the meantime, who cares? And my concern with the way that vintage watches are covered and spoken about in the media is that whole world of just having a great time with old stuff isn't spoken about, and worse, is kind of poo-pooed. You get words like Frankenwatch and all that sort of stuff, which kind of says that's not to be done. And to which I would say, who are you to say that?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that scares me when I'm buying. And if they list it in the listing and they're honest about it, then cool. Like if I like the watch, that's one thing. But a lot of times they're not. And I think that's where the concern comes from, especially from me. I buy with reselling in mind. I don't wear my watches that way, but as we talked earlier, you know, I do like to sell watches. I do sell them to move on to the next one. So yeah, that has also kind of scared me about vintage, because I tend to like newer things because I feel like I can just wear them the way I wear watches and just be more comfortable. But yeah, that's what scares me. I like this watch. I think there's a really cool blacked out watch. If it had a replacement dial and they said that, I don't think that would bother me too much, because I like the watch and I could probably still sell it because they're pretty rare. So yeah. Just being I think like a lot of eBay listings, I think there's a lot of redialed Pogues that either they don't know or they aren't going to tell you.
My gut feel is in 99% of cases, the seller has no clue about whether this has been redialed or not. They don't know. If you buy, a watch I bought recently, an Alpina. Well, actually, this one I know was my most recent one. I know was real because the guy that was selling it, it was given to him as a confirmation gift.
Okay. So
he'd had it for like that long. But I've bought other watches that have come out of Lithuania and then found their way to Estonia and then gone through Poland, turned up in Germany, and then eventually got sold to me 50 years later. Is there a chance that somewhere along the line some new hands, a new crown, a new dial or new case back was put on? Almost certainly. So, but did anyone pay attention? Almost certainly not.
Right.
Probably no one along there even knows what happened. So I just take the view, this is how I manage this problem. There will be people who will specify that everything is original, that they've got, they can tell you exactly what it is. And then for me, that sets the price of what is supposed to be original. And then I assume everything that's below that price is probably been modded and repaired and serviced and has a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
So if I see a watch I'm kind of quasi-researching now, like a Breitling 809, which is the original Cosmonaut, the 24-hour dialed manual-wind version of the Navitimer from way back then. If you see one of those advertised as totally original, you know, everything in place in great condition, it's like 30 grand.
Yeah.
So if I see one for 7 that looks in pretty good nick, it's a redial. You just know. You don't need to be told. It is.
Yeah.
Well, you did tell me when you set the price.
Right.
Because so you just assume it. If you're paying a third the price of a watch which is being advertised as fully original. Yours is not.
Yeah.
And if you're happy buying that, and I am, and the idea of a resale, you know, if I buy that, you know, Breitling 809 for, you know, $6,000-$8,000, I'll sell it for $5,000-$7,000. You know, I might lose a couple $100, I might lose $1,000, but I'll be able to sell it. Not that I actually want to. That's not how I
– No, you don't sell.
and the biggest problem would be probably that it would take ages to sell. It's not like there's a million people out there wanting to buy like 1960s manual wind 24-hour chronographs.
Right. Same with this. Like these, I kind of, I did try to sell this briefly. One guy was interested, then ghosted me, which is just confirmed that I'm done selling watches because it's such a freaking pain in the ass. But yeah, there's a limited market for niche quartz vintage watches, Seikos, even though it is a pretty historical movement, in my opinion. You have to find the right buyer, and that takes a while.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing with the big consequence you have with having more unusual watches you really get to choose what's going to hurt.
Yeah.
If you want to sell it fast, the price is going to hurt. You're going to have to sell it cheap. If you want to sell it at a decent price, what's going to hurt is it's going to take you 6 months to find the buyer. That's the – when you start buying older and more unusual watches, that's the trade-off you're making. It's going to hurt to sell. Just what kind of hurt do you want?
Right. Going back to what you were talking about with maybe being redialed and you being okay with that in certain times, yesterday on a Seiko Facebook group, have you heard of the Seiko 6306 that's co-branded with Scuba Pro? They made them in like the late 70s. They're like a diving company. They go
now.
Yeah. Okay. So those, last week there was one, there's a vintage site in the US, DC Vintage. They sell a lot of like the Pogues and the Bruce Lee, speed timers and that kind of thing. They had one of those on there for about $3,000. They made them only for a few years from like 77 to 81, I think. So they're pretty rare. If you can find one that's truly authentic, that's what they go for, about $3,000. That one sold right away. On this Facebook group, Seiko Facebook group yesterday, there was a guy who was selling one for $3,000. And of course he got trolled. You know, like people were, is this pesos or dollars? You know, all the troll comments that you get. And then there were people who were saying you can buy these all day on eBay for $400 or $500. And it was all of these, again, like you were saying, if it's that cheap, then you know it's not authentic. It's not real, right? Does that matter to you? But these guys, I don't think they knew that they probably weren't getting 100% authentic. So there was a little bit of like back and forth, which I kind of participate in sometimes. I hate when people troll for sale posts, like, you know.
Yeah, it is a funny thing. And that's where I suppose there is an element of you need to know the market.
Yeah.
And like with a lot of these people, they clearly don't know the market.
Yeah.
They don't truly understand the market. But that's easier than trying to and that's why I don't mind playing down the shallow end of the pool, if you like.
Right.
Because it's relatively easy to figure out, okay, so I know what a great price is, I know what a good price on a totally original one is. I know what I'm likely to be getting, you know, broadly speaking, if I'm not 100% original. You can work that out actually pretty quickly. And you don't even have to be an expert on the watch. You don't have to spend hundreds of hours, you know, going through, you know, and for a watch I did do, this was actually for a video where it became super important to know whether this particular watch was released in 1970 or 1971. And because it's the sort of mistake you don't want to make for the YouTube commenters.
Yeah.
And to find that, I ended up having to like talk to a mate who spoke to someone who gave me a WhatsApp group phone number for a guy in Switzerland who had like one of the original catalogs from 1971. So, and it was 1971, by the way.
the things you have to worry about.
And so I did that for like one watch in one video, but and there was nothing really writing on it other than some, you know, pain in the bum comments. But if you're doing that for every watch and you're doing it for the dials and the case backs and the crowns and the bracelets and the hands, and you're doing that for everything all the time, trying to figure out whether this is original or not, I don't have enough hours left in my life to make that worthwhile.
Yeah.
I'm not doing it. So I'm just in the world of saying, if I'm paying a third the price of a really good condition one and it looks in good condition, it's not original. And that's fine with me. So then it just becomes a case of what the way I then respond is, following that process, I've been dudded once of the, like I said, 30 to 35 watches that have gone through my hands. There's been one case that I learnt from, which was, it was not that the watch had been redialed. I had assumed it had been redialed. Actually, I'd assumed it had been redialed. It had not. It had been repainted badly.
Okay.
And so for me, I'm less concerned about whether it's original and more concerned about if it's been messed with, have they messed with it in an – I would rather get a water-stained, sunburnt dial that was – broadly original and otherwise okay than something that some ham-fisted amateur had tried to clean up.
Yeah.
That's where I draw the line. And you don't, again, you don't need to be an expert. You just ask them, can you send me some high-res photos of this part of the dial, please? And you don't have to know it. You just have to decide, do I like that or not?
I have a local watchmaker who has always been great to me. So we were talking, I saw him with my dogs. He was running and he said, yeah, you should come by and see some watches. I have an old Explorer 2 that I just kind of refurbed in an old, 60s Speedmaster. So I was like, okay. So I looked at the Speedmaster first and he had done some repairs, but he hadn't touched it, hadn't polished it or anything, left it really cool. And then he showed me his Explorer 2. It was his own personal watch. And I could immediately tell that he did some brushing and some polishing on this thing. And I love the guy. He doesn't listen to this, thank goodness. But I was actually thinking, like, because it was the old 40mm size, which works better on me. And I was like, for a brief second, I was thinking about how can I make this work. And then I saw kind of the butcher job he did on it. And luckily, I was able to see it in person. Like, if he was selling that online, I don't know. I think you can immediately tell. I mean, you can be a kind of a novice and even looking for polishing. I'm not really an expert on that at all, but it was pretty evident that it was not the best job.
Yeah, I'm not necessarily a big. It's funny. I'm not a big one on the idea of getting watches polished. I don't mind if. I mean, I've clearly, your viewers or your listeners, thankfully, can't necessarily see that. You know, like my head has been through the ringer. it's been a bit beaten up along the way. So why should my watch be much different?
Right.
You know, I don't mind that it's a bit scratched up.
Yeah. I may buy to resell, but I certainly don't wear to resell. I wear without a care for the most part, within reason. But yeah, I don't know. I'm rough and I'm active.
And so, like I said, I'm not anti-polishing, but like my story with this dial, I'm anti-bad polishing.
Yes.
And good polishing is really hard.
Yeah.
The people that can, you know, do a case really, really well, A, they're pretty few and far between, and B, it can get really expensive.
Yeah.
So, you know, if I'm dealing with, $4 million Paul Newman Daytona. Oh, you know, fair enough. Get it polished and get a guy and pay someone 10 grand to do it.
Yeah.
But if I'm dealing with a watch I've got, a $200 Alpina Tropic Proof, which I bought for the simple reason that the idea of having Tropic Proof on the dial is so cool, when it arrived, it had a bent lug. Actually, that's not true. I knew it had a bent lug before it even got to me.
Okay.
So this is how cheap that watch is. So I negotiated the discount, $25, 25% of the price of the watch. but you know, and it's like, who cares? At the end of the day, it's a watch from what, 1952, 1953. So it's a 70-year-old watch. It's got a bent lug. It's perfectly wearable. Who cares? Big deal.
I knew I wasn't super into vintage watches when I had one of I had the first production year Pogue that still had proof waterproof on the dial instead of water resist. I knew it was original. I got it from somebody I trust, and I got it, and I was like, oh, the condition, like the, you know, the dial was deteriorated, you know, sunspots, or, you know, was peeling away in a couple of areas. The bezel was all scratched up. I think most people would have been like enthusiastic with the condition of that watch. Like, oh, this is an original condition. I was just like, eh, I don't think this is for me. I'd rather be the one putting all this, all these scratches on.
No, and that's absolutely fine. I mean, people, first off, not my job to tell people what they should.
Right.
One of the things I look at, and a lot of people talk about that, you know, I want the memories. I want the memories of my memories of that watch to be my memories of that watch. And I understand that. I suppose I look at it a little bit the other way around. Like, this watch will still be around after I'm dead.
Yeah.
It's not about, you know, in a strange way, it's not about me and my memories. It's about the watch. The way I put it is that watch I was talking about earlier, you know, originally from Lithuania via Estonia into Poland, made it over to Germany. That's a watch that saw the rise and fall of Stalin. It saw the Spring Revolution in Czechoslovakia. It saw the fall of the Berlin Wall. It saw the reunification of Germany. And now it's traveled around the world and it's sitting here in like suburban Melbourne, walking my dog on a beach. That is a cool story.
It's cool. Yeah.
It's the watch's story. It's not my story. It's the watch's story. And that's the way I look at it. You know, when I look down, it's not all about me. So when I look down at this tropic proof watch, which clearly was not very tropic proof, I find myself thinking, yeah, well, what happened to you, little man? What was done to you? I promise I'll treat you nicer. But so that's how I look at it. There are limits. I have a watch which I bought through gritted teeth, worried about whether this had gone too far. And even now, you know, $400 worth of I'm exaggerating. I can't imagine how much $400 worth of Polly watch would be.
Oh, God. But, it's like $5 a tube. You'd have a lifetime supply.
I know. But, you know, huge amounts of Polly watch and huge amounts of effort. And this thing still... It let's just say it doesn't get a lot of wrist time, but thankfully it didn't cost a lot of money. It cost significantly less than a normal old everyday Swatch, not a moon Swatch, just a normal Swatch would cost. But it's pretty beat up. It's pretty ugly.
I get what you're saying about the whole romance of like imagining what a watch has been through. I have a 1940s Gruen Curvex that was gifted to me, but I should have brought it down. I was meaning to actually, that was gifted to me by, one of my clients, and he bought it in a store, just a tiny watch shop in 1983 in New York City. So I often wonder like, cause it's a tank style. It's pretty small. But I enjoy, you know, when I wear that watch on every New Year's Eve since I've owned it, that's probably the only time of the year I wear it. I just feel like it's a fitting, we don't do anything. We sit and watch TV on New Year's Eve, but I still feel like that's a good New Year's Eve watch. And I feel like somebody wore that watch on New Year's Eve in like the 40s and the 50s and did like fun things with it. And we're, you know, binging Cobra Kai or something on New Year's Eve. Like, it's not nearly as exciting, but I imagine, how did they get to that store in 1983? This guy, he's an adventurous guy. He goes surfing trips and everything. So I'm sure he took this watch to do some of those types of adventures. So yeah, it's also now it just sits in my watch box and doesn't get many adventures. But
I actually do occasionally, if I'm doing it, particularly doing a work trip, think about that and think, you know, like these watches that did have such wonderful stories now, you know, live their life in a watch box.
Yeah.
Upstairs bedroom. you know, oh, they must, it must be, I don't know if it's like, if watches had retirement homes, it's where I am now.
Yeah. Right.
But I did a trip to, with work, which I absolutely hated, but, I had to go up to Papua New Guinea for a couple of weeks. And I took a whole bunch of vintage watches, A, because they're really, really cheap. And if you get robbed, it's no big deal.
Yeah.
And B, it was a good opportunity to get a bunch of wrist shots of a vintage watch on the, you know, on the streets of Port Moresby with everything going on behind it, and just feel like, okay, I'm doing my bit. I'm breaking the watch out of the retirement home. And we're going out for a bit of a spin and adding some more, you know, stories to it.
That's cool.
So, yeah, it's just – it is funny in that on one hand, I hate the expression, it's just a watch. And the reason why I say that is I think you and I met because of watches.
Yeah.
You know, we're friends because of watches.
Right.
I have so many friends, John, that I do my podcast with. You know, if it wasn't for watches, I wouldn't know he existed. And there's a whole friendship that just wouldn't exist.
Yeah.
And so turn around and say it's just a watch when it's actually such an important connection between people, I don't like it. It sort of devalues what's going on. But at the same time, you know, it doesn't mean I baby them. It doesn't mean you treat them with kid gloves. You, when it comes to how do you live with it on a day-to-day basis, it's just a watch.
Yeah. I get sad when people don't wear their, you know, watches they spend a lot of money on. Like you should not feel, I don't know, and maybe like they have reselling in mind. You know, everybody has a different relationship with money and everything like that. And, you know, could they afford for their very expensive watch to get really scratched up? Like that's a case by case basis. But I probably couldn't afford for my Moser to get too screwed up. I mean, I could, but I'd be really bummed. But I still wear it to do a lot of stuff most people would probably shriek at wearing a Moser, a dress Moser for. But the movement's shockproof. I don't ever feel like I'm, you know, I don't know. I'm not throwing too much at it.
Yeah, and that's, I'm the same. I don't buy to sell, so I don't worry too much about resale value.
Yeah.
You know, you don't be stupid about right. it. With my vintage watches, the one rule I've got is, you know, assume that they all have zero water resistance.
Yeah.
And so that's in terms of babying a vintage watch, I'm very careful around water. That would be the thing. What's actually really interesting, it's slight diverge, when you go back into, like, you look at a watch from the 1950s, you look at some of the advertising from the 1930s, 40s, 50s, no one cared about water resistance. It didn't even feature in the ads until, like, the late 30s, early 40s. They were all concerned just about keeping dust out.
Yeah.
So they spoke about dust resistance. And if you crack those old watches open, quite often, yeah, they've got dust covers inside them.
Yeah.
So if you've got that in mind, this was why, you know, these guys were worried about keeping great big particles of, you know, crap out of your watch. Then, yeah, they were not thinking very hard about keeping water out.
Well, just think there were probably no paved roads, dust, everything was dusty all the time. Dirt.
That's right.
Yeah. So that probably was a major concern.
Yeah, so I just have that in mind. That's the one thing. Even, you know, I was talking to someone the other day. I think vintage dive watches make great modern dress watches.
Yes.
Because they're small, they're fairly discreet, terrible dive watches. I would never dive with one. Even at the time when I was there, you know, I dove during the 1980s. And, you know, I look at this little 30, I used to look at my little 38 millimeter dive watch thinking, this is pitifully small. Next to, you know, if I had my, the actual, it's a bit of a giveaway. If you looked at the size of the dials on the regulator, they were like 50 millimeters across because that's what you needed to see. And we, you know, we were diving with these pissy little 38 millimeter
yeah. watches.
You know, clearly watches designed by people that didn't understand the legibility requirements of being underwater, but you just made do with what you got.
I like a smaller watch, but some of these people I see online want like 36 millimeter chronographs. Like, you must have amazing eyesight. Jeez.
That the Sprint I showed you is a 38 millimeter chronograph, and it's pointless. You can't read any of the subdials. I spoke about this. I get a lot of heat for it when I say this. One of my things, which is, people in the past only wore small watches because they didn't get a choice.
Yeah.
People go, oh, back in the day, a 38 millimeter was considered a jumbo. Yeah, right. And that's the problem. They didn't get the choice. They didn't get to buy a big watch because it topped out at 38. I have a suspicion that if you could go back in time and get these guys who were, really squinting hard to look at their 36 millimeter barely loomed field watches that they wore like as they stormed the beaches and said, hey, I can give you a modern 40 millimeter properly loomed breakbeat dial. Oh, they would have killed for it. They would have shot you in the head and taken the watch off you.
How big were Fliegers back in like World War II? How big were they?
This is a really interesting question. It splits. So there were the very specific kind of Fliegers that people have in mind, which are the big German ones, hence Flieger. They were actually ex-pocket watches. So they were built around pocket watch movements. They wanted bigger watches, but back then all movements were pretty small. So then you sort of have to jump to a pocket watch movement, which now means you're looking at a 55 millimeter watch.
Okay.
So those Fliegers, those early big German Fliegers were like 55-ish millimeters. On the Allied side, so if you look at things like the Dirty Dozen watches and the original Mark 9s or Mark 10s that IWC made, fun fact, at one point IWC was making watches for both sides. In the war.
Oh, I didn't know.
So if you're looking at those watches, they were really small, 36, 37 mil. And again, what's interesting is none of that was really designed in what we would call a modern ergonomic, driven by anthropomorphic kind of data sizes. They were just what was available. It's interesting that when you look at what happened with mil-spec watches like during the 50s and the 60s when suddenly, science came to the fore and people were sitting down and going, what can people actually see and read effectively? Watches suddenly got a lot bigger.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, if you are genuine about the idea that your watch is a tool, then legibility trumps comfort when you're wearing it.
Yeah.
And so one of the things I, absolutely cackle at these days is people who absolutely positively insist that these tiny little barely legible watches are tool watches. No, it's not.
I mean, the SJE093, which is the new 62 Moss, which is 38 millimeter true to the original. I like the way it wears just for the simple fact that it's not as tall. They put the thinner 6L movement in. And I had the SLA043, which had the 8L movement, and those just sit high and tall, and with the like stumpy lugs, it's just an awkward wearing experience for me with a 7-inch wrist. So I prefer the fit, and the size is okay. It works. It's a little small. I don't notice how small it is until I see it in a picture and like, oh yeah, it does look kind of small to me, but it's okay. But I just prefer it from a height perspective. It wears much better.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I'm like I said, it's an interesting thing. I'm not saying that everyone's – that's the curious thing. An actual dive watch is – and like, I mean, an actual dive watch that you're using as a real tool, as a real tool watch, only needs to be comfortable probably over a neoprene wetsuit and only for an hour or two while you're diving.
Yeah.
Because if it's an actual tool, when you break the surface, you'll take it off, you'll put it away with all your other dive gear, and then you'll get the more comfy wear it all day watch. What we've done now is blur that line and say that the tool watch designed to be worn over a wetsuit and just while I'm underwater has now has to conform to the day-to-day, nothing to do with its tool function.
Desk diver.
and be a desk diver. And so it's – well, maybe what it comes down to is a new Rolex Submariner is a tool, but it's a tool for a very different purpose, and that purpose is not diving.
Yeah. I met a guy I'm in another like local Boston watch group here online, and I discovered one guy to talk to. We live in the same town, not too far, so we got together last Sunday morning for coffee, and he had his Submariner on a Marine National strap. It looked pretty cool. Looked kind of badass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm not a bracelet guy, so if I can take a watch off a bracelet, I will take the watch off a bracelet. So I've got 50-something watches, 3 of them on bracelets, and that's because they're all integrated bracelets. I don't have a choice.
I'm surprised you haven't even tried to take those.
I have. and it just got too hard. I think personal, this is in a way going back to this idea of Franken watches. I've personally never modded a watch. I don't think of, changing a bracelet as modding,
Right.
But so I've done that. But I must admit, I've never really modded a watch. I've never been motivated to mod a watch. But at the same time, I kind of wish I did. I wanted to. I'm thinking about it one day. Because it's kind of a reaction to all those people who get really puritanical and clutch their pearls when you do. That just makes me want to do it more.
Right.
and then secondly, I am getting to the point where I look down at my watch boxes and it's full of, really nice, largely as it came out of the factory, this is what they intended to, pieces. And it's getting increasingly hard to find a new original and, space to go and to make my collection something it wouldn't otherwise be.
Right.
So maybe I'm beginning to think the only way I'm going to get there is to say, buy a watch but then put a funky dial on it, something quite different that no one else is making at the moment. That could be the only way my collection continues to grow.
I've had
probably
some...
not there yet.
Yeah, well, I think you even said in your podcast you've collected almost every style of watch like you're really wanting to collect. I think maybe some more world timers or some other complications maybe. But yeah, then where do you go from there? So yeah, modding might be where you go.
Yeah, so a world timer is the next big thing. I don't know which one, but then after that, it's like maybe it's then the mod world because. Yeah, after a while, you get to the point where I've got a black dial dive watch and I've got a blue dial dive watch and I've got a green dial dive watch. You either stop, but that's just crazy. or you find some way of doing something completely different.
I have a friend, and I don't know if he actually did this. I'll have to ask him, but I would be interested. He took, the Casio Duro, like the $45 Casio dive watch. He was going to get it oil filled. I thought that would be a pretty cool mod to do. I think he was maybe going to do it himself, but then I think he found somebody that could do it for, not so messy. Those are tricky because the battery, I don't know. The battery life probably is pretty good. Casio's battery, I've always found them to go way longer than they specify.
Yeah. The oil filling would be fascinating. The sort of visual result you get is really bizarre.
Legible, super legible. Unless you get a bubble in there.
That's right. And it kind of changes. It makes it look like that's how it's like those Resonance, if I've said that right, that Resonance brand. They use something similar. And it makes the hands and the indices and everything look like they're painted on the backside of the crystal. It's a really odd, disturbing look. Zin make a watch. I'm probably too lazy and risk averse to try a mod of that. Maybe I'll get there one day, but I'm more likely just to shell out the money for a Zin. They make one.
One of the topper out here, they had one pre-owned for it would have been probably about, I don't know, $1,700 a few weeks ago. And I'm just not in the market right now, but I was like, this would be a great opportunity to take a pre-owned chance on the oil-filled diver just to see what it's like. I've watched videos on it, and it looks crazy legible from all sorts of different angles.
I know, and it's not only legibility, as like I said, it's this weird kind of otherworldly look.
It'd be fun to try on a Casio Duro, just a low risk. If you screw it up, so what?
That's true. I mean, the mod probably, if you pay someone to do it, I reckon the mod will cost you more than the base watch.
And you might as well put a sapphire crystal on that also costs more than the watch.
That's right. I was looking at one of the, talking about my vintage watches the other day, and I found myself thinking, I was looking at like the opened up the box. I'm looking down into one of the boxes, and it occurred to me, I've spent more on the straps than the watches in that box.
Yep. Oh yeah. So I've owned a couple watches that the straps have definitely cost more than the watch. The cheaper quartz watches that I flirted with putting an expensive rubber strap on my moon swatch that cost almost as much as the moon swatch. I haven't put it on yet because it doesn't quite go, but I'm not going to buy another one, but
yeah. Oh, I was messing around. I'm somewhat unique in the I think I am totally unique in the watch YouTube world. I'm being a bit facetious here. In that I am the only watch YouTuber that actually bought with my own money an Artem sailcloth strap.
Oh, I have too.
It feels like everyone else gets them for free.
Yeah.
So I bought them, and then bugger me, but they're actually really good. So I bought another one. But then, yeah, I did throw it on a vintage watch and then realized that the strap cost twice as much as the.
I have it on the SJE093 right now. I love it. Yeah.
Yeah. So I've got mine. It switched. It went from probably an $80 vintage watch. And it's now on my Grand Seiko. But which gives you some idea of just how flexible those bands are. They're amazing.
So the one I have is 20mm and the lug width on the Seiko is 19, but I just crammed it in. And it's easy to get off because they have drilled lugs. So if there were no drilled lugs, it'd be tricky, but with those, it's easy.
There is one of the downsides of vintage watches. You'll become very familiar at trying to find 18mm lugs.
Yes.
And then one day, I won't break it out. It's buried in another watch box. I bought a watch I really wanted to get. One of the things I do is I collect vintage Alpina watches. And vintage Alpina, there are two distinct, really three distinct eras of watch. There's all their really early stuff where they were pretty much just like every other watchmaker, you know, right up until like 1938. And in 1938, they introduced this one, for them, seminal watch. They called it the Bloch Ur, and it was their first and one of the very, very first watches in the world sold as a sports watch. And so the advertising was with people skiing and people mountain climbing and people like doing all sorts of sporty things with it. And then after that, they went down, they had the Alpina 4 route, which was really the development of that Bloch Ur into a modern sports watch. And I've had a bunch of the early ones and I had a bunch of the later Alpina 4s, but I wanted that one in the middle. I wanted to get the original Bloch Ur. And I've been searching for ages. And I eventually found one, and I had to spend big money on that. It was like $300 or something. came on this ratty old bun strap. It was absolutely horrible. And before I'd even thought about it, I'd thrown that bun off because I thought, that's not going on my wrist. Then I found out it's got 16mm. What am I going to do? I'm still trying to find it. I just jammed an 18 in there. But I'm going to have to find someone who'll sell me a 16mm.
Yeah, gosh. That's tricky. Maybe just cheap company on Amazon or something.
I think it's going to be some Alibaba Express thing. But and to put that in perspective, what size watch has a 16mm lug width? It is 29mm.
Well, I remember you saying before you're into bigger watches, but it's the fact that some of your vintage Alpinas are so small that gets people talking. That is like the thing that draws people to them. Like, what is that? Like, because that's the interesting thing about it.
That's right. So a small vintage watch is intriguing, but a small modern watch is just a small watch.
Yeah.
Is kind of where I've come from. Is I can look at, as I said, that 38mm barely readable vintage chronograph, but I'll forgive it because they didn't know any better. But in 2023, there's no excuse for making a chronograph less than 40 millimeters.
Yeah.
You know no one's going to be able to read it, but you made it anyway.
Well, anytime like you see a Facebook post with a like the new Longines chronograph, for instance, everyone's like, well, if it was 36, I'd buy it. Like, really? Yeah, like again, what do you have, Superman vision?
Well, no. And what it comes down to is there's an expression of how modern watches have truly just become, you know, fashion accessories. Yeah,
no one cares. You know, no one uses the chronograph.
Ultimately, they don't care. Right up until you challenge their manhood on owning jewelry, and then suddenly they're like, oh, no, it's not jewelry. It's a tool. And then they try and figure out how the chronograph works as they're explaining to you why they bought it as a tool watch. I suppose from that point of view, if you do just roll with it and say, you know, the watch is jewelry, and my daughter is not into watches at all, but you know, she gets, you know, I make her watch videos on YouTube when she comes over because I'm that kind of parent. And I'll do the whole, you know, what do you think of this one? And do you like this? And she's kind of vaguely, if I come at it from the point of view of this is an accessory you might wear, she suddenly gets much more interested. But yeah, she likes the watches with the little watch dials in them.
Oh.
That's what she says. So I said, what do you mean? She said, you know, the watches with the little dials in them. And I've gone, oh, chronographs. She goes, oh, yeah, I don't, whatever they're called. I just like the look. And I think people that want 36 millimeter chronographs are just like much better informed versions of my daughter.
Yeah.
They know the right words, but fundamentally, they're just after a fashion accessory.
I was in Michigan visiting my family a few weeks ago, and my cousin, her husband is a lovely guy, and he actually was wearing a G-Shock and like the Casio Royale, but we did like a barbecue and he had a chronograph on, and I said, oh, what is that? It was a Pulsar, and his mom got it for him when he graduated from high school, and he still wears it, and the chronograph hand was misaligned. All the subdial, they were all misaligned. I think that happens after battery changes and stuff.
Yeah.
So I was like, I'm going to fix this for you. And, he's like, really? You can do that? I just wore it. I thought it was busted. And I'm like, no, I'll do it. So I realigned everything for him. I had to watch a video because there's like certain modules have different methods. So I figured out how to do it. I did it. And he's like, now, should I leave this running all the time? Or is that good for the watch? I was like, no. So this is a timer. And I explained to him. He's like, oh, this is cool. I can time. He has to take his little son for a drive to get him to take a nap. So I was like, you can time that. Like, so he's like, oh, that's really cool. So he's had this watch he's in his late 30s. He's had this watch going on 20 years, and he never knew that. Now he does. So maybe it's like a new appreciation for the watch or something. So that's kind of cool. In closing, so people who might be a little, any advice for people who maybe, you know, follow the advice of the gatekeepers, if you will, like to get into vintage, like what they should be looking for. Do people actually fake vintage watches, or is it just sort of the Frankenwatch thing that happens more?
In my experience, it's generally the Frankenwatch thing. And it's funny, when we started this conversation, we started talking about, watches of the 80s and 90s are sort of becoming vintage watches now. That's also the period of time where I think fake watches started to become a bigger deal.
Mm.
So I'll be, from my point of view, when I'm starting to buy, call them neo-vintage watches from the 80s and 90s, that this watch might be fake starts to become a much bigger thing in my mind. If you do look at like the replica sites now, you can find, particularly if you look at some of their like their past stuff, you know, they were selling fake Omegas and Breitlings and Rolexes back in the 90s.
Okay.
So, yeah, there is a real risk that could happen. If you go much before that, the technology to make something like a chronograph was pretty rare. The idea that you could knock one up pretty cheaply in the 1950s and 60s, it just didn't happen.
Well, this is the first analog quartz movement. It came out in 1983. So,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, the idea that there's someone faking, you know, those original ones, very unlikely.
Yeah.
And you know, like we spoke earlier about the difficulty selling boutique, unusual, not particularly in demand, vintage watches. you are the world's worst businessman if you decide that that's the watch I'm going to invest yeah. all my time and effort into faking, the watch that takes me 6 months to sell. So I think the biggest issue, the when you're buying vintage and you're buying it like me, so you're buying it as a someone who just likes the look, who likes the aesthetics, who likes the stories that the watches come with, but you're not in it to invest and you're not going to be running around trying to, you know, match numbers and everything. For me, it comes down to the following things. This is what I look for. One, do I like the look of the watch? And what I mean by that is everything I said before, it's not whether it's in great condition or not. I'm assuming it's not. It's not whether it's necessarily been redialed. I'm assuming it has been. But rather, if some restoration's been done, does it look good?
Yeah.
Or did they, you know, have they tried to do it with a house brush? if they've done it with a if they've redialed it, does it look like it's an original redial, like an actual service part? That's fine. But again, if it looks, you know, if it looks bad, it looks bad. You know, the issue there isn't that it's not original, it just looks like crap. So the number one thing I look at is, do I like the look of the watch? The next thing I look at is serviceability long term. And so you can normally do this pretty easily. 99.9% of old vintage watches will come with, which is another slight side point, will come with, you know, this is an Alpina 1234, this is a Breitling 678, whatever. But for 99% of the time, dig one level underneath that. It's an old Venus movement. It's an old Valjoux movement. It's an old Unitas movement. So if you're looking at a vintage watch and you're scared about serviceability, look at the look at what the movement is. Do some research on Google. Go that one level down, and if it's based on a Venus, Unitas, or Valjoux movement, it's almost certainly going to be serviceable. There'll be parts around for it. If, on the other hand, it stops there and it truly is in-house, run like there's no tomorrow. Do not buy that watch. Because if something goes wrong, then you're in full resto mode, ripping the movement out, putting something completely different in.
I had an Oyster Quartz, and that's ultimately why I moved on from it, because I was a little – I'd heard that you can get them serviced from Rolex, and then I started to hear stories that they are a bit of a nightmare to get serviced. Oh, they're pretty bulletproof, but if they do break, yeah.
That would be my – you know, the one part of – and it's funny, you've been much braver than me. Vintage quartz scares the living daylights out of me. That's one of the reasons why you can get really cheap, probably $1,000 US, a little bit more, early Breitling aerospaces. I'm a Breitling guy. I'm an aerospace guy, pilot watch guy. I don't mind quartz. All of those things are yelling that this is a watch I should own. But the idea of trying to get like those movements serviced just scares the bejesus out of me. So I don't do vintage quartz. And there might be people out there who would say, Pete, you know, go learn something. There you go. You'll learn something new every day. But at the moment, I don't do that. So, yeah, they're my two. Oh, and the third one, which I already mentioned before, you don't necessarily have to know the watches, but you have to know the market.
Yeah.
So if you're looking at old mechanical, particularly old mechanical watches, find what a really good, really original one would look like, and no, there are no bargains. If a really top line one is $3,000 or $10,000 or $30,000, and what's being offered to you is half or a quarter or a third that price, it's not original. Deal with that in your head, and then move on. And if you're happy spending, you know, I'm at the point where I'm happy spending $2,000 or $3,000. On a watch that I know isn't original but looks really good, and whilst there are replacement parts, the parts are most likely, you know, from the factory, good enough for me.
Yeah.
And that's all I'm after.
And I think if you buy like me, like maybe resale is in the back of your mind and you know you may not keep it, especially if you're not sure that you jive with vintage watches in general, buy from buy from a trusted vintage dealer. Hub City Vintage is great. That's where I got this. DC Vintage. They both specialize in, Seiko, mostly vintage Seiko. They can see a Faco from a mile away, and they'll call it out. So those guys, you might pay a little more. They charge more than other places, but you're paying for it. They also service the watches. Spencer Klein is another guy who knows Seiko inside and out. He services the watches too, if you so choose. I just assume everything on eBay. Again, if you're okay with it, that's fine. I assume everything on eBay has some sort of, it's been tampered with in some way or another. I just automatically assume that going in. So I think if that's important to you, and also box and papers aren't necessarily as important for selling in the vintage world as they are in the modern.
they can be almost non-existent.
Right.
It is a strange thing. I wonder where we'll be in 20 years time with box and papers. I have a suspicion that the reason they became big was because they used to be so rare, but now that we're in a world where every watch comes with box and papers, maybe it doesn't matter so much anymore. No, I don't have box or papers with a single vintage watch I own. And if I was to go to my Chrono 24 notepad where I've got maybe 30 of these watches, I'm sort of just watching away. There's not a single one offered with box and papers. Oh, actually, that's not true. There's one Breitling Chronomat that comes with box and papers, which is really hilarious because it's this like multi-$1,000 watch in this little cardboard box.
Yeah,
part of me is thinking, what were you thinking? Why? What was the owner of this watch some hopeless hoarder? Why have you even got this? But there's an interesting little quirk. I'm watching this watch, and it is kind of interesting because it is literally double the price of any other Chronomat for sale, and it's not in as good condition. It is not as good to look at, which probably means it's original. So there you go. You ask yourself, do you want to spend, say, $4,000 on a really nice-looking watch that's got a couple of service parts in it, no box or papers, or do you want to spend maybe $12,000 on a watch that doesn't look as good, but it's all original and got box and papers that you then have to worry about?
Is that really the price gulf?
Yeah.
Wow. Wow.
I know my answer.
Yeah. I think I know mine too, but the Eric Wins of the world will take the $12,000 every time.
That's right. And then he will look down on you and he will tell you that you don't have a vintage watch, you only have an old watch. And that's the attitude that really gets me. This idea that there's only one way to be into vintage. We were talking about it before. One of the things that I just find really laughable is a lot of the watches, which in that world are nowadays regarded as important, were totally disregarded when they were new. They were completely unpopular.
Yeah.
And it's only an accident of history that's made a watch, which at the time, something like the Daytona, was deeply unpopular and not in any way, shape, or form special, horologically or in any other way, but purely as a result of market forces, has now become a collectible in the same way a baseball card is. And that somehow makes it important, more important than maybe the Zenith El Primero that, you know, was the originator of the movement that went into. It's just, I just really dislike the way they think about vintage watches and how they gauge importance. And so if I was going to say anything to your viewers, your listeners, be careful, have an idea of what you want, don't overspend, blah, blah, blah. But vintage watches can be huge fun. You can really play around and have a great time, and you don't have to be, a cardigan wearing, leather elbow pad, pipe smoking guy to be the sort of person that's into vintage watches. There are fun people doing this too.
Yeah. I wish I was. I think I've told you before, and you kind of did a video characterizing different types of collectors, and I'm a wearer. I'm not a curator. I wish I were, because there are like the Spring Bar website has a guide on these watches. There are like 50 something different variants. I would love, like, if I had my druthers and had the money to do it, and also like didn't get stressed out if I have that many watches, like Jeff McMahon. I turn into Jeff McMahon when I get too many watches. But I would love to have a collection of these. I think that would be so much fun to hunt them down and, find, you can probably find different models that are maybe in better condition than others. This movement is in the Ripley, all the Aliens watches, the Jajaro, all the other Jajaro stuff. They did some really funky stuff with this watch and this movement. So I'd love to collect them all. But
yeah, there's a guy that Seiko Todd that we do the the live stream. He's got. I'm gonna say, I might be wrong, but it's in the order of 40 something Seiko speed timers.
Wow.
He says himself, you look down in the watch box and, you know, at first glance, it can be difficult to know. It's like having 40 identical twins as your kids. It's difficult to tell them apart, and then you feel guilty that you can't do so. But I totally get that. I like with my, I said this before, my Alpina collection is kind of laid out chronologically. And so you start from the earliest and go through the latest. And it's kind of, I like it. Sometimes you just stare at the box in the same way as you might stare at a big exposed cliff face where you've got layers of the geology and you can look at it, you can see where things happened. You can kind of see the same as this. You lay this out and you go, I can see as we moved from the very ornate 20s to the 30s, and I can see as we went to the austerity of the 40s and the World War. I can see what happened when modernism struck and you've got the 1950s watches. I can see how that started to break down in the late 1960s, and then I can see how everything just went insane during the 70s. I've got all that in a single box of watches.
That's so cool.
And it's fun. Yeah. I like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I still like flirt with the idea of, because they've made like dress watches. There's one that's really cool. That's like Breguet style hands, but it's essentially the same layout. It's just you can tell they're related, but it's the same movement, but it's just a completely different style watch. That would be cool to have. They made a funky one for cycling where the dial is actually on a tilt. So when you're cycling and you look down, you kind of like the driver's watch, like the Vacheron or the Longines. So you can see it when your hands on a steering wheel. So yeah, there's enough diversity and variety within that series of movement watches that I think you could have a pretty great collection. They'd all be chronographs, but still there's something, they all tell a different story and are different enough.
Yeah. And I think, and there are people who collect that way and there are people who don't.
You know,
there's a million different ways to do it. And like you said, there's people who just want to wear it and that's what they do.
Yeah.
You know, not my job. I always try and when I do a video about, you know, different types of collectors, I try. I clearly fail because in the comments people get really angry. But I try and say I'm describing different types of action. I'm not trying to say that one is better or worse than the other. It's just clearly if you do look at the way that people go through their watches, there are obvious differences. And however you do it works, whatever works for you. I ran a video sort of series where I do this sometimes. I put a video out where I ask for questions. What do you guys think about this? Tell me in the comments below. And then I turn the responses into a video. And I had this idea once where you see people put their state of the collection up and it might get, you know, 500 views, 1,000 views, and maybe 200 people will say, nice collection, bro. What did the other 300 think? Did they just move on, or were they thinking, I don't really like that collection?
Yeah.
And then that leads to the point of, are there bad watch collections? And what is a bad watch collection? And so I asked my audience, I said, what would you think of as a bad watch collection? And the overwhelming answer was a watch collection that the collector themselves don't really like.
Yes.
And I think that's more than anything. If you like your watch collection, I don't care what it is. I don't care what's in it. I don't care how you bought it. I don't care if you bought it because it gives you the most clicks on Instagram. That's perfectly valid. If you bought it for because you want resale value, all power to you. If it does what you want it to do, you're a good watch collector.
Yeah, right.
If you've got a watch collection, I think one of my guys said it very poetically. He said, if you open up your watch box and all you see are a bunch of regrets, you're bad at this.
Yeah. And I, like, just coming full circle to close here, Adam Levine probably really likes his collection. And he was talking, I rewatched that video tonight just because I knew we were going to talk about it. And he was talking to Ben about the Artisan de Genève Daytona he had with the luminous dial. And he said there is rebellion in changing things that people don't want you to change and in modifying. And that's what draws him to it. So maybe he knows he has redialed Daytonas and he doesn't care because it's different and he knows people will hate it. I don't know if he knows. I have a hunch he doesn't know, but... Yeah.
I suspect he doesn't know, yeah. Although there was particularly the bezels. I remember someone saying there's every chance that he or his watchmaker actually has the original bezels stored. There's actually quite a market in those old ones.
Yeah.
Because the bezels are old and they're aluminium and they're easily scratched up. There's quite a trade in taking off them and putting like wearable bezels on. So which is always a possibility,
yeah,
too.
So
but my view is, so Adam Levine, a guy who's not that into watches, has a bunch of watches that, let's just say, I assume make him happy.
Yep.
He's not selling them. He's not doing anything to anyone else. If you jump on and, you know, pick at those watches and then put a video up and call them Franken watches and crap all over them, how did you just make the world a better place?
I agree.
And that's it. You know, that's fundamentally, if what you're doing doesn't make the world a better place, why are you doing it? And that's what, that was my complaint about that video, the response to that video.
Well, I think we just made the world a better place. I don't know about you.
if nothing else, we just distracted some people from maybe a bad day. So that's
right. Got them through mowing the lawn or doing something. Right. I have a tree. I think I told you in our chat, we had a tornado come through here today. I have a gigantic oak tree down in my yard that thankfully spared the month-old brand-new fence that we put in.
You're so much more masculine than me. I have an incredibly exciting afternoon of repotting indoor plants. That's the kind of man I am.
Oh, we're a tree service is coming to remove the. I mean, it's they have to cut down two giant oaks. I just have to do the residuals. But that's not till Monday. But I'm bracing for that. But yeah, it was pretty. It was pretty crazy wind. This is hurricane season. Never really had a tornado come through, so that was kind of scary. Getting the alerts on the phone and get to the basement. Like, should we go in the basement? Yeah.
So you're Rhode Island.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't know they got tornadoes.
I've lived here 17 years. Never
trailer parks.
Right. Yeah. Sometimes you get a freak event. it came through real quick. It was very fast, like 20-second, like insane burst of wind.
Yeah, well, it is 2023, so yeah. When we wrap up, I'll take my vintage watch off. I'll put my 1,000-meter diver on, so I can go repot some indoor plants. I think the watch will take it.
We're actually doing a weekend at the ocean this week, so I'm actually going to take my diver into the water. like 2 feet probably. And
Sure? You're up for it? You better make sure you've got at least 200 meters water resistance and a screw down crown.
Oh, I'm going to rinse it for a half an hour, but salt water, you know, it's going to do some real damage. So
it's special water.
well, Pete, thank you so much for taking the time. This is a lot of fun. I've always wanted to do an episode about vintage watches, and I knew you were the guy to do it with. So thank you.
I'm the guy to talk to about how to do it badly, apparently. But
no, I don't think so. No, you. I think there's a lot of people. I think there's more people like you that don't sell than there are me. It seems like there's more people like me, but I meet more and more people who just buy to keep. Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I know a lot of people like that. So why don't you plug all your stuff? Okay. You've been active on YouTube again.
Okay, so I'm Pete McConville. Easiest way to find me on YouTube is just search that name. It's just Pete McConville. I was one of the people of that trend that went and renamed all our old channels. On Instagram, I am one more word. So just pete.mcconville.watches. And I'm also part of a podcast, so Hot Take Time podcast. We're on Spotify, and I finally figured out how that mind twisting world of Apple works.
Oh, you
so
got
we're
it?
Now on Apple. I did. Oh. I did. Oh man, that was a day of my life I'll never get back. Yeah, so that's all done. So Apple, Spotify, Google Podcasts. While I was there, we went for Pocket Cast and all the others as well.
Oh yeah,
because once you've figured out Apple, you may as well just keep going.
And I think being on Apple automatically gets you on a lot of those things too.
Which does too, yeah. Which then took me another probably hour to figure out, like, why won't you let me enter it? And I worked out, oh, it's just flowing straight from Apple. So, yeah, that's it.
Awesome. And I'm going to put a link to Sam's channel, Casual Watch Reviews. He does two live streams a week, Sunday and Tuesday, and you're usually on those, right?
Yeah, so it's funny when people say that. So for me, it's in Australia.
Yes.
It's first thing Monday morning and mid-morning on Wednesday. but I think for the rest of the world, it's Sunday evening and Tuesday night.
I still get an absolute kick out of the time difference. Watches made it possible for me to talk to someone who's halfway through tomorrow already. It's pretty darn cool.
That's right. Just give us a call if you want, like the winners in the next horse race or the lottery numbers. I'll see if I can find them and get them back to you.
I'll of course have you back on sometime soon. But until then, thanks again so much, Pete. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. See you later.
Okay. And remember, sometimes you're the dog, sometimes you're the hydrant, but at least you're outside. Thank you so much for listening. We'll catch you on the next episode of the Watch Dog Podcast. See you later.